Good evening. I'm Ellen Rocco in this evening with my co-host, Betsy Capus. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
And we have Jane Urquhart on the line with us from somewhere in the wilds of Ontario. Welcome, Jane. It's wonderful to have you.
Wonderful to be here from the wilds of Ontario. I'm just across the lake.
I know. I'm just trying to make it sound exciting, you know. I just want to let listeners know that this edition of the program is a way we're sort of stepping off into new territory, which we hope to develop more fully in coming months and years, a kind of book club, more of a book club format for the show. We'll be talking about books before the programs air or before the conversations happen on air. We'll be talking about specific books online. You can find it all at ncpr.org/bookclub, and I hope you will check that out. We're looking for participation by lots of individuals, book clubs, etc. We're looking for titles, future titles, and we're going to ask Jane before the end of this show what she recommends. A note that Readers and Writers in all its various permutations is supported by the New York State Council on the Arts Literature Program and by the Corning Foundation. And before I hand it off to Betsy for a bit of a more formal introduction of Jane and this book we'll be talking about tonight, Sanctuary Line, I just want to say that I have been wanting to get Jane Urquhart on our air for a long time, going back to when I first read The Stone Carvers. And I'm delighted that you're with us tonight.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful to hear.
And I'll turn it over to Betsy with that.
Okay. First of all, everybody should know that Jane has written 7 novels, a book of short fiction, and 4 books of poetry. And The Stone Carvers, which Ellen mentioned, was a finalist for the Giller Prize and longlisted for the Booker Prize. So she's a big name in Canada, and more Americans, hopefully, too, will read her. And when we get just a tiny little beginning here for people who haven't read the book, a 2-paragraph little synopsis of what it's about. Here we go. Liz Crane, the 40-year-old narrator of Jane Urquhart's new novel, Sanctuary Line, lives alone on the north shore of Lake Erie in an old farmhouse surrounded by abandoned orchards. She mourns her cousin Mandy, a brilliant scholar and military leader killed by a bomb in Afghanistan. Urquhart's prose is rich and unhurried as she spins a story of migration to Canada, the 19th century Irish, Mexican fruit pickers, thousands of monarch butterflies. The book moves between past and present, compiling a thick layer of stories to explain the events of a summer night that shattered Liz Crane's world. So, Jane.
Before you go any further, if you are listening and you plan to read Sanctuary Line, Betsy and I promise not to be plot spoilers tonight.
Right.
There's lots to talk about here. We don't have to get deeply into the plot line. So,
how about me? You didn't get me.
No, you are not going to. You're not going to tell the plot because you want all those listeners to go out and buy your book, right?
Okay.
All right.
You've convinced me.
Yeah. So, Jane, the first thing I'd love to know, the sense of place is wonderful in this book, imagining that farm along Lake Erie. And do you have a farm like that in your past, or did you completely make this up?
Well, it's a composite, actually, of parts of my past. My family had a cottage on the shores of Lake Ontario, and in fact, I still own that property. And unlike almost anyone else in Canada, my family members went south in the summer due to the fact that I was born in the far north. So, you know, we had to come back to a particular area. And the reason that we came back was because my entire extended family, who were mostly farmers and who were agriculturalists of one kind or another, lived in the area around the place where my immediate nuclear family had purchased the cottage. So, like Liz Crane, I did have that whole experience of migrating back and forth from, first of all, the north, and then later in my life, the city, to a place that was in the country and was surrounded by farms run by my uncles. Now, I have to tell you, this is terribly important. all of the good things about the uncle in Sanctuary Line are exactly like my beautiful bouquet of uncles. I had six of them. And none of the bad things about the uncle in Sanctuary Line are, have anything to do with beautiful uncles of mine.
Great, great. And some of them are probably still alive.
No.
Well,
one of them. Only
okay.
one of them is
okay.
the last.
Yeah.
You know.
Before we move along, I just want to let listeners know that this is very much an open conversation, and if you're a fan of Jane's and you'd like to just pop in here and say something about this book or about anything else you've read by Jane Urquhart, please join us at 1-877-388-6277.
Jane, I'm going to... we live in a very rural area here in North Country Public Radio. And so a lot of your rural descriptions really hit home with us. And I was thinking, I don't know if you have a copy in front of you, if you would mind reading for us on page 138 of the paperback.
Well, actually, I don't have a copy.
You don't have a copy. Okay, then well, I guess we can
But you
read
can
it.
Tell me what that is about, and I can paraphrase it.
Yes, that would be good because it, as Betsy was saying, it's not just that You describe a rural landscape, and your observations are about a world that's based in farming and nature. It's that it's the same place. It's the same place that we live in. We live in the northern grounds for the monarchs. We have the same demise of small farms. So it's very resonant.
Yes, and also in Sanctuary Line, I think it's important to note that the family, we follow that family through several generations in a rather unusual way. We do it through stories rather than through, long descriptive passages concerning various generations of the family, but that there is a mirror image of the family on the other side of the lake, which
yes.
is, of course, upstate New York, and another farm that is an exact, it's the same but slightly better in the minds of the family, which I kind of enjoyed writing about, I have to say. But it is true that in fact, I believe your side of the Great Lakes is perhaps even more agricultural than our side, mm-hmm. which is hard to believe because we always think of America as the big kind of industrial place, that has all the big, big cities and stuff. But in our particular part of the world, it's not necessarily so. And all of the fruit farms that exist in Ontario are starting to be cut back rather dramatically, and the cities are growing by leaps and bounds. But whatever the case, fruit farming takes place on both sides of some of the Great Lakes anyway, Erie being an example of one of them.
Right, and we have the big area on Lake Ontario just to the west, the east of Lake Ontario, too.
That's right.
You also, the main narrator of this book, Liz, she says on one page, she says, "Sometimes I feel the past will eat me alive, will devour me in the same way that the now abundantly overgrown cedar bush is devouring the pioneer rail fences on which, as children, we used to stand in order to watch the Mexicans work." And that's sort of, the narrator of this book is definitely drowning in the past.
I think that that's true almost everywhere around the Great Lakes at the moment, in the sense that now this particular narrator is extreme in her reactions to what is going on, and she's attached to a past that she sees crumbling around her. But I think we all see this and we all feel it in the sense that the architecture is starting to kind of decay, the barns are starting to disappear from the landscape, and essentially it's all attached to the demise of the small family farm and the rise of the agri-industry on the one hand, and certainly in our case, the expansion, as I mentioned, of the cities. But these places were not necessarily invented by the small farm, but certainly those of us who arrived in the last 300 years or so were some way or another engendered by these small farms. Clearly, the First Nations people were here long before we were, and they had another whole reality to deal with. And perhaps this is one way of understanding their reality and how painful it must have been for them to watch their landscape be destroyed by, you know, the removal of vast sections of the forest so that this very small farm world could be created by the pioneer settlers who arrived in this part of the world. But I find, much like my narrator, that there is something terribly poignant about the decay and decline of all of that. And I think we do see it very, very definitely in this part of the world.
So here's a question I have about that, because I'm about the same age as you, and I've been in this part of the world on a farm for about 40 years. And when I arrived, it was kind of the last of the old small dairy farm culture around here. It was sort of really changing dramatically. And after 10 years or so, you know, the 40 cow can make a living off of a 40 cow farm culture was gone. In those days, 120 cows was a very large dairy for this neck of the woods. But, you know, I try and sort out how much of what I experienced of that then is not, if you are today on a large agri farm or whatever, where 600 to 2,000 cows are being milked, which is not terribly large compared to the Midwest, but that's as big as they get around here. I think our largest dairy around here is maybe 2,500 cows. And, you know, I'm shocked because cows aren't out on the landscape anymore and all those things. And, the workers seem to be transient in some way, even if they stay for some time on a particular place and come from far away. I'm wondering if 20 years from now, the people who are living that life now won't feel as we feel about the life we knew on the farms 20, 40 years ago.
I think that's entirely possible. I think that we all have a tendency to in some way idealize our past, unless our past is so painful and so awful that it's impossible to do so, which is sometimes the case. But I also think that part of the book is about that. It's about that whole notion of this kind of almost idyllic childhood, which was not what it seemed at all. I mean, in fact, it was much darker and much stranger in many ways than Liz herself believed, and a kind of awakening to that at adolescence that happened to her. So, yes, I think I'm not sure that memory isn't completely selective in the sense that it has a tendency to kind of light almost like a butterfly on you know, bright flowers rather than go into the shadows. And so perhaps it will be possible. I mean, I've even with my apparently wild imagination, I've been told I have a very difficult time imagining that you could in any way idealize being a worker on a mass producing farm run by a corporation. But, you know, people do develop relationships. They have, you know, they have times together. I mean, often almost anything can be made at least more beautiful, if not fully beautiful, by the kinds of relationships that develop around it. And hence you have, you know, people who have worked in factories all their lives but have formed extremely close friendships under those conditions, even if the factory was very, very difficult to look at in any kind, with any kind of real sentiment as an artifact or as a work of architecture or as a place, you know, like place is still place, whether it's beautiful or not. And I think that's something that one should be mindful of.
And of course, the uncle in this book tells stories about the past, which we aren't sure if they're true or if they're his imaginings of the past. And, you know, that's, again, what is the truth? We're not sure.
And also, I think he's a man who is torn in a way. I mean, he is obviously the beginnings of the agri industry in mm-hmm. so many ways, and one of the most important ones, of course, being that he hires Mexican pickers to come and work on his farm. But he's also, you know, doing things genetically, trying to get crops to happen, you know, strawberry crop to happen twice a year, or you know, produce things. We get bigger crops using chemical fertilizers and all of that. And I think, he has a tendency to fully sentimentalize the past to an almost ridiculous degree.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, while he himself is kind of pushing into the future, on the one hand, he's looking back with this kind of sentimentality to a multi-generational past, but he can't quite make it real. He can't really bring it beyond the level of myth and incorporate it in any way into his own life, because he is so filled with forward momentum when it comes to the business of, you know, being a person who's spearheading the agri industry.
We're talking with Jane Urquhart. You can join the conversation. The book we're focusing on this evening is Sanctuary Line. And you may know Jane's work from the Stone Carvers, from her Away. I know there's a group that's reading Away right now, and I suspect are listening. Feel free to join us at 1-877-388-6277. That's 1-877-388-6277.
Jane, I always wonder, I like to write too, and I always wonder what comes first when you think of a novel. Do you have the setting? Do you have an idea of plot? Or what came first with this book?
Well, interestingly, this book happened to me in a slightly different way than others. I always say books happen to me in some crazy way. I don't happen to them. Often when I'm beginning a book, what I find is that I'm not even entirely sure that I am beginning a book. I'm intrigued by many things, of course, but there will be one or two things that I'm really fully intrigued by. And I find that if I've been unable to forget about those things, I have to pay even more attention to them and realize that it's a novel waiting to be born in some way or another. Now, in the case of The Stone Carvers, which was a book partly about Canada in the First World War, but mostly about the building of a gigantic war memorial in France representing the Canadians, I found that I was obsessed by the war memorial on the one hand, but also by the building of a church in rural Ontario in the 19th century. And so I wrote the novel to find out essentially why I was so interested in these two seemingly disparate things at the same time. And that's how the Stone Carvers was born. With Sanctuary Line, I was driving down a road near here where I am, Colborne, Ontario, and I looked at a tree. It was the middle of August, and I looked at a tree, and the tree was bright orange, and I thought, that tree is, the leaves are changing on that tree, and very early, and what's going on? But then as I looked closer, I realized it was a butterfly tree. It was entirely filled with monarch butterflies, so much so that you couldn't see the leaves on the tree. Just, you know, hundreds of thousands of them on this one tree. And at the same time, I looked beyond the tree, and I saw Mexican laborers working in a field, in a strawberry field. And I thought, this is really interesting. These monarchs are going to Mexico, and these people are going back to Mexico as well. I had never thought about that before, never made the connection. And there was a third thing that came into play at this point, and that is that as a child, at that piece of summer property that I mentioned before, I every summer saw a butterfly tree because it was at the end of our lane. And once I saw the tree that was not at the end of our lane, I realized for the first time that the butterflies had stopped coming to our summer place. So all of those things kind of connected in my mind, and I became very, very interested in the whole migratory patterns of monarch butterflies and all of that and what had happened to ours, you know, because we would see those butterflies every summer, and then, as I say, they were suddenly gone. And I became very intrigued by the whole notion of migration and of all kinds, including immigration and emigration. And I realized how important, in spite of the fact that I thought that this part of the world was forever emplaced, that really wasn't the truth. You know, first of all, it was settled by people who had immigrated from another country. They had pushed out other people as a result of their arrival, and there had always been people on the roads, and there had always been migrant workers of some form or another, even if you take into consideration the hired man.
Mm-hmm.
But now, here were these people who were coming from Mexico and who were not part of the community in any real sense, and who were being housed in not particularly tremendous quarters. And I began to become very concerned about them and interested in what it was that was happening with them on these farms. And so those two things really started the novel for me. But there was another thing again, and that was I had been visiting the Royal Military College in Kingston as a result of research for previous novels. And while I was there, talked to classes, which included obviously a number of officers in training who were in those classes, and I found these young people to be so bright and so fascinatingly interested in things such as poetry and the kinds of subjects that we wouldn't necessarily associate in a stereotypical way with a military college, were not only being taught there, but were being embraced and celebrated by the students who were attending classes. And at the same time, our country became involved in war in the Middle East and Afghanistan. So I was aware that these young people, many of them, would likely be on their way to Afghanistan, and we have always been a nation of peace, well, not obviously in the Second World War, but we're known for our peacekeeping. This change had happened. A combative role had entered the scene without anyone paying too much attention, and it kind of slipped by, and so that was intriguing as well.
Yes, and you bring that in well. The woman who has been killed in Afghanistan actually was an English major, or she should have been. She loved poetry.
She was an English major.
She loved poetry, and that's right. She did her thesis on The Child's Garden of Verses, and so it was kind of fun to have the poetry be part of the book too. The doggerel, some of it, and what was the difference between doggerel and good poetry and bad poetry? That was kind of fun too.
Mm-hmm. Well, the doggerel, in fact, is based on an actual book. No, and not in the 19th century, actually, 1880s, I believe. And it really was published by a man who was a Baptist minister, so I hope I haven't offended his shade. But there are a few of those books floating around still from that period that are, especially ones that are of nationalist nature, you know, the kind of Maple Leaf Forever.
Yeah.
Well, we have those too, and often those poems would show up in local newspapers. They'd be a weekly poem from the local poet laureate, and so we're familiar with that kind of text.
But I liked it.
But you know, there was something too about that at least I felt was uncomfortable, you know, for the children on the one hand who didn't quite get what was so funny about it, and the kind of sincerity that went into the writing of those poems. You know, they were about something, whether the person who wrote them was able to express himself in a way that we would consider art or not, and the hilarity on the part of the adults in regard to that. There was something that just felt a little odd and
a little mean.
A little mean.
Especially since he was, you know, the man wrote out of suffering.
Well, precisely. Yeah, and the whole business about they being sent off to look for little for the grave of the child that was often being written about in the book.
Yeah, and then of course there was the little story about the man and the woman he loved who wrote verses for greeting cards.
That's right.
So we got really little poems there.
That's true. I've often wondered about that. I guess that's probably why it ended up in the book. How it, you know, having that as a career. And what that would have been like, and how your own experience would have perhaps filtered into it, or maybe not. You know, maybe you would be writing greeting cards about experiences of life that you had never ever gone anywhere near.
Yeah. So we're talking with Jane Urquhart, who is the author of 7 novels and. Is Sanctuary Line your most recent, Jane?
Yes, it is.
Yes, that's what I thought. Her most recent, I think in this part, in this country, probably The Stone Carvers has had the widest readership, I think. Certainly one of the great fiction voices of North America, I think. And if you've read any of her work and are curious about her as a writer, her book, any book specifically, it doesn't have to be Sanctuary Line. Again, you're welcome to join us this evening at 1-877-388-6277. Betsy, there was a section that we both agreed was so on the money for, we talked a little bit about it, but maybe you want to read that page 138. Jane,
sure.
If you can stand hearing someone else read
your work. Listen, I'm delighted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. This is describing what it's like there in southern Ontario, but on Lake Erie. There's hardly anything left of the 19th century now on the north side of the lake. The remaining barns in our township have been reduced to skeletons. You can see their graceful beams and rafters, the gaping spaces that would have been their wide entrance doors, and sometimes a last load of hay in a sagging mow, placed there years ago by a farmer who either lost heart or died, or both. Occasionally, an oxen yoke can be seen fastened between two upright boards, or a harness hanging from a nail on what would have been a stall. These old essentials, of no use now except as objects of curiosity, seem almost to have become part of the decaying structure simply because they have not been moved or touched for so long. Most of the old frame houses have been replaced by newer models, or torn down and not replaced at all, their foundations plowed under the huge fields of factory farms. Other smaller fields go back to bush if they are of no use to the agri-industry, or if they've not caught the eye of a developer. And in the villages, shops and stores, still vital in my own childhood, have either become boutiques or pizza outlets, or have no life at all, their windows boarded, the signs above their doors fading.
So that was that felt so North Country to me. And to my mind, what really separates the village-centered, smaller farm-centered life and culture of that sort of pre-World War II, whether it was Ontario or northern New York, culture, is the automobile, in large part. The automobile that made it possible for people to travel miles to go to a store versus being more closely located to their nearest village if they were farmers. I've noticed around here, and this may be true in Ontario as well, when you travel through the Adirondack North Country, townships tend to be on the order of 5 to 15 miles apart from each other. And I think that's based on a reasonable distance for a horse to do in a day.
Yes, I think you're probably
right. Yeah, actually, I have to say, I worked for a geographer one time, and it's called Central Place Theory, the idea that the distance between big towns is the distance you could walk or ride a horse, you know, so that there's a certain distance.
So that I didn't make this up.
No, it's called Central Place Theory.
There's a name for it. I'm amazed.
But up here, you see, we have something called regionalism, which has taken over from that. And that means that they have amalgamated several townships into what we call a region, and also, you know, amalgamated the governments of those places. The small town councils and all of that have disappeared from the actual villages and have become, centered in one usually slightly larger place, and that has taken yet another kind of life out of those villages and moved it into the, and also it has encouraged development of a kind of, I'm having a hard time understanding even really what it's about, the development of subdivisions around the central axis of a small village, but I'm not quite sure who it is that lives there, except that perhaps, you know, as you mentioned, the automobile, you may be dealing with commuters. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's a fascinating thing and kind of a scary thing because it's happening very quickly as well. And the reason that it's scary to me is that my family, like the family in Sanctuary Line, was Irish in origin. And as a result, I have migrated back to Ireland and lived there part-time. And that means that I've been there watching what happened during the Celtic Tiger economy when 375,000 poured concrete two-story houses were built on the island of Ireland.
Oh.
And these houses, I mean, way more than that were built, but these 375,000 built within 6 years have never been lived in. And if we're to believe the newspapers, they never will be lived in. They're called ghost estates. That's what they call them, because an estate is a housing development in Ireland. And they were built only in order to, they were built by developers as a result of greed, and they went too far.
Yeah.
So that can happen, and I know it can happen because I've seen it. And, of course, those kinds of things were on my mind as well. It was fascinating to be in Ireland because you could see a landscape that had been the same for a very long period of time disappear into this kind of hideous, scattered, unplanned, developer-driven housing estate world that was of no use to anyone, really, in the final analysis.
And yet most of the action in this book is that, again, that nostalgia for supposedly better times, and you know, as you're reading it, you're like, well, as you say, it wasn't as bucolic and beautiful as our narrator thinks it was.
No, and of course, the same thing is true when I'm, you know, of the notion of Ireland. I mean, had people like me got their way, Ireland would always be a country filled with little sort of lovely white cottages with thatch roofs, and the people would still be burning turf and walking up and down the roads with donkeys. But in reality, the truth is that was a deeply uncomfortable way to live. Mm-hmm. That, you know, people, the reason that people were living in those little cottages was simple. It was called poverty.
Yeah.
And, you know, along with the 375,000 houses that will remain empty forever, side by side with that, there came a desire on the part, and not, you know, not unusual desire, and certainly one that we all have a right to access to, and that was to improve your life. And so, it's all a matter of balance, I think, in the final analysis.
And of course, in Sanctuary Line, the people who are receiving the short end of the stick are the Mexican workers who have to just, you know, live in the trailers and go,
yes,
you know.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's always somebody, you know.
Yeah.
I was thinking the other day about the First World War and how when I was doing research for Stone Carvers, or the book before it, The Underpainter, my husband and I went to the battlefields, and they looked pretty grim in many, many ways, including, of course, the huge cemeteries filled with crosses and many, many crosses. So many young men were killed in the First World War. But we also noted there was a cimetière chinoise, and we thought that was a little odd, considering it was being run by the British Battlefield Association.
Hmm.
These were the coolies who had been hired to clean up after the First World War.
Hmm.
There's always somebody, you see. And they were hired to do work that was so dangerous and so awful that they didn't feel that, the powers that be at the time felt that those coolies were less than human, and therefore they would be, it would be okay for them to do the work. And of course, it was dangerous enough that many, many of them were killed by shells that were still very active.
And in your book, Sanctuary Line, of course, the border is crossed when the white girl falls in love with the Mexican boy, and you know that that kind of.
Yes,
forbidden love, right?
Exactly. And I mean, it wasn't, you know, the adults around her were sophisticated enough not to ever suggest out loud that, you know, this is a kind of racism that is so subtle that there was any difference between the kids who were white and the little Mexican boy or the older Mexican boy as the time went on. And yet there was no question that in the minds of the adults there was a difference. And that was perhaps one of the hardest things to write about in Sanctuary Line without overstating the case. You know, to make it clear that this line of racism was essentially there, and it was one that really couldn't be crossed, but without overdoing it in terms of the characters who were probably guilty of carrying around that kind of systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even their acts of kindness were so condescending in a sense that.
Well, that was kind of. That pervaded the culture, our cultures at the time, I think,
exactly.
Too. I mean, they were
absolutely.
Operating within, so that, and anyone who had moved past that was unusual, actually, not typical.
No, that's true. And so, you know, the uncle appears to have moved past that, and maybe in some way he has to a certain degree. But it just, I mean, I remember. There's a policeman toward the end of the book, and again, as I say, books happen to me in some insane way. I don't happen to them, and who makes a remark that is so chilling.
It is. That was very chilling when I read that.
And it was very chilling for me, because by this time, you know, again, it's terribly exciting sometimes when you're writing and the book starts to take over.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it isn't as if you're sitting down consciously and thinking, I know, I'm going to have that policeman say something really bad. But essentially, the character just opens their mouth and says it.
And it felt totally, you know, those words have indeed been spoken by someone in a similar context.
Yeah, but it was like a slap to read that.
Oh, yeah. I want to open up the conversation here to Ginger, who's joining us from Borrego Springs, California. I assume she's listening online, and she has a connection to this neck of the woods in the summer. And Ginger, we're delighted to bring you into the conversation.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be a part of it. Jane, I'm just reading Away, and I'm leading a book discussion of it next week here in the desert, and most of the people who live here, or many of them, come from the West Coast. So much of what you're talking about is unfamiliar or
I was
distant.
Going to say, absolutely.
And, and
I like
so
the desert part.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said I like the desert part.
Yes, well, but I just what you were saying just now about the racial issues in Sanctuary Line, which I have not read, just made me think of the difficulty that Brian O'Malley and that Liam had when they moved to Ontario.
Absolutely.
Because they were treated horribly.
By the powers that be of the day, which would have been usually British officials. So, yes, you're referring to the fact that these characters emigrated to Canada during right in the middle of the potato famine when mm-hmm. things were at their worst, and only to discover when they got to Ontario that the same kind of discrimination on the part of the British was here waiting for them. And yes. that was very true. The Irish, in fact, Catholics generally, could not even run for public office in Ontario till about 1950. So it was a pretty tough place to try to settle in as an Irish Catholic settler. And the other thing that made it even more complicated was that the Northern Irish Protestants had been here first as well. So you had the British on the one hand, Northern Irish Protestants on the other, and in come these terribly, desperately damaged people, many of whom don't make it through the first winter, actually, as you can imagine, because they were not, I mean, they'd already been suffering from starvation for a long period of time, and there was nothing really in place to incorporate them into the society as it existed at the time, which would have been the 1840s, late 1840s. And I was going to say that you're absolutely right.
Go ahead.
They experienced similar, I mean, well, in fact, they experienced racism. There's no question. I mean, they were the same color as the people who were dismissive with them and actually kept them out of the society as much as possible. But it was racism, and it was a kind of unbelievably entrenched hatred, in fact, on the part of...
Mm-hmm. Well, I was interested also before I called, you were talking about people taking care of the people who were less privileged and living on the farms where they weren't able to produce anything in Ireland. And then the two of the characters who just absolutely jumped out at me in a way were the Sedgwick brothers.
Oh, yes. I had fun with them.
Did you have fun with them?
I did. I mean, they were in the sense that they were. I don't know, in fact, to be honest, how typical they were of the Irish landlord of the day. But you know, on the whole, the Anglo-Irish landlord was a very eccentric animal. You know, they really were into collecting little sort of life forms from beaches and trying to preserve animals, to, you know, stuffing animals, and they were into that whole natural history thing.
Oh, that was the period, the mid-19th century.
That's right.
That was happening everywhere, I think.
But it's interesting that you bring up Away, because in a sense, Sanctuary Line was an answer to that book, and written much, much later, of course. I wrote Away, it was published in 1993, I think. And I would have been writing it from about 1989 on. And Sanctuary Line, of course, was written, I would say I probably began it in about 2008. So almost 20 years later.
Huh.
And in a sense, it's kind of an answer to a way in that the family itself is the result of that kind of emigration from Ireland that happened during the famine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had the feeling that, I mean, I liked the way you brought in the background of the people in Ireland and how over the time of the book, I'm not even sure what the period of the book was, 1842
just past 1867, in fact, because that was the time of the Fenian invasions and the moment of our only political assassination, and that was of a Irish Catholic MP called Darcy McGee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I loved the way that you incorporated the poetry, both of the Sedgwick brothers and the poetry that the immigrant Irish Catholic teacher brought in.
Yes. And that was, I had been reading Irish poetry since I was old enough to read, practically, because like the uncle in Sanctuary Line, my family, my uncles insisted on on paying attention to Ireland. One of the things that I've always said that was so weird about growing up in a situation like that was that even though my uncles had never set foot on the soil of Ireland, they would weep copiously if they listened to Irish music. They would become tremendously sentimental about Irish poetry. They would, espouse Irish causes. They would threaten to join the IRA, even though, you know, they were thousands and thousands of miles away, and they detested the British. Now, I should add here, having said that these people were Quins, and it was my mother's side of the family that was, you know, and so they were actively Irish. They felt more Irish than the Irish, and we grew up with that. We grew up believing that if it was Irish, it was sacred in some kind of way or another. So that included the poetry, and as I got older, I moved further into Irish literature and started reading a lot of fiction as well.
So I would like to just insert here that we are talking with Jane Urquhart about First Sanctuary Line. We veered off a bit to talk about Away. Thanks so much to Ginger for joining the conversation. And I think it's interesting that to note here for our listeners that Jane is not only a fiction writer, she's also a poet. And that may be part of the reason that poetry seeps into her works of fiction as it does. She obviously has a love of and ear for poetry and writes poetry herself. So, again, there's still time to join us if you'd like to talk with Jane Urquhart at 1-877-388-6277.
And I'll talk about something else that Jane brings into Sanctuary Line. She brings in some science with the monarch butterflies. That our narrator is a scientist at a sanctuary near the old farmhouse. And here's a little line about the monarchs. As for the monarchs, in those early summers, we didn't even know where they went or where they came from, depending on your point of view. We simply accepted them as something summer always brought to us, like our own fruit, or like strawberries or corn at roadside markets, or, for that matter, like the Mexicans. And it's kind of, I love the way in some ways the butterflies, of course, are the freest migrants in the story, although they have this horrible journey they have to make and there are fewer and fewer of them. But it ties in really well with the people. Was that fun to do or was that hard to do?
Well, it was... I think it was more difficult than I had originally expected it was going to be. Again, it was one of those things that one of those moments when I had to become fully conscious, which is not something I enjoy doing. I'm a bit of a daydreamer. I prefer to stay, as my daughter always used to say, in outer space. But at that point, I mean, first of all, I had to be accurate, but
right.
But also I didn't want to overdo the metaphor. I mean, it was just too convenient as a metaphor, so I had to kind of haul myself back in at moments as well. But it is fascinating to pay attention to those butterflies because, you know, they go through various transformations from, you know, the chrysalis and into the butterfly and beginning with the caterpillar. And then they spend the rest of their lives flying back and forth to Mexico. And in fact, it's only the last generation that makes it back to our part of the world. The scientists refer to that generation as the Methuselah generation, and then it in turn goes back to Mexico. But that's the generation that's born in the north, and I find that very, very interesting as well. But they're very beautiful, and they're very fragile at the same time. And why they choose to fly over Lake Ontario or Lake Erie when they could probably find a little, you know, certainly Lake Ontario, they could just go down to the St. Lawrence River to achieve the same thing. But it suggests to me that they must have been migrating like that since before the Ice Age.
Oh, what a wonderful thought.
Yeah, it is great.
Because I don't think that, you know, those kind of survival patterns are usually relatively practical. Now, there'll be some scientist around who will prove me completely wrong.
Oh, but I love it. I love that it's sort of carried forward that far. That's wonderful. And that it's the path, not the landscape under them that matters.
Uh-huh, exactly. And that's why they will fly, you know, directly over the city of Chicago or something,
right,
in spite of the fact that it's a bad thing to do and they get caught in updrafts and fly into buildings and have other problems. But it seemed to me that what I was writing about really was migration. It really was about, the entire book was about migration of some form or another. And I always think that by the time I finish a book, I should know something that I didn't know when I began. And if I were to point to one thing that I found out as a result of writing Sanctuary Line, it would be this whole sense that in spite of the fact that my narrator and perhaps myself is mourning the loss of place, that we're not really in place anyway. If we look at it from a longer distance, we've always been migrating.
Yeah.
Humans migrate. We've always been moving across vast tracts of land. And I guess that the butterflies, who seem to be so much more aware of it. I have a First Nations friend who keeps saying, well, the things about insects and animals is they do what they're supposed to do. The butterflies just keep on going. You know, this river of butterflies keeps on moving back and forth. So that whole sense of the of how life is about migration, even if you don't move, you know, something will move around you. So change, and that the opposite of, you know, the emplacement is important as well, but that, you know, you can't push that too far because the opposite of change is stasis.
Mm. Yes, you know, one of the things that surprised me as I was getting to know some of our Amish neighbors, and Ontario is another area where Amish families have settled. You know, I know you have a number, because I know some of my neighbors visit their families in Ontario.
Sure.
What surprised me more than anything else about my Amish neighbors is how much they move around. I think of them as kind of, or I did think of them as kind of, you know, quaintly getting around short distances on horses, and that was sort of, that sort of drew the circumference of their capacity to, as we were talking about earlier, their capacity but they're, it's like, I'm not kidding, they move all the time. It is really quite extraordinary. And
yes, I lived in an Amish part of the world for a bit up here as well. And yes, that's very true. It's very true. They're much less sentimental about land than we are.
Much less.
And therefore, which is interesting to me, because they, within their community, have preserved that kind of 19th century way of life.
Precisely, and I think maybe it survives because they aren't sentimental.
That's right.
Quite a practical approach to land.
That's very true, and it also suggests something else that I discovered from writing Sanctuary Line, and that is that though obviously there are a lot of good things attached to being sentimental about place or being filled with sentiment, which would be a better way of putting it, because sentimentality kind of puts me off, but there are a lot of good things about that, including, you know, the need or the desire that's born as a result of that to preserve landscape, to preserve place, and perhaps to honor and pay more attention to the earth upon which we walk and live. On the other hand, you know, as you say, the Amish move. They move because they're practical and out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps some of this, I mean, if you push it too far and you become sentimental about place and about things staying the same and not changing, perhaps that's born out of a kind of privilege. In other words, the need isn't there. Therefore, we feel that, you know, we must stay. We must preserve whatever it is.
I sort of experienced that this weekend. I was down near Boston and some of the wealthy suburbs, and all the old, beautiful old farmhouses and barns are lovingly restored by millionaires. You know, they're not really being used except for maybe a horse or two. And you definitely get, you know, it's all beautiful and old-fashioned looking, but not
and
used.
And yet there is something about those places that suggest, I mean, I can, you know, how did you know they were millionaires? You knew they were.
I did, yeah.
And you didn't go and knock on their doors and ask them, did you? You knew they were not the real deal.
Yeah.
And therefore, somehow, I always feel that places like that have had their soul torn out of them in a way. They've been over restored. You know, it's almost like whatever that past was, it's been lost as much as it would have had they torn it down.
Yeah. Yes, and lost as much as the landscape around it has been lost to farming. You know, a small pasture with a pretty white fence is not a farm.
No, it isn't.
Jane, we are going to have to leave you soon, and I thought before we do, if you can tell us who you're reading, who turns your fancy, or I'm sure you're not one of those writers who never reads, so...
No, I've always said, if somebody asks me, okay, you have a choice, you can give up reading or you can give up writing, which will it be? It would be writing. I definitely read. Okay, yes, I would like to mention two people.
Great.
That I've been reading recently. One of them is a Canadian writer. Her name is Lisa Moore. And she's a Newfoundlander. She lives in Newfoundland, and she's a really wonderfully gifted contemporary writer. And one of the things that's so interesting about Lisa's work is that while it speaks to the place of Newfoundland in many, many ways, she takes an urban view. Hmm. It's a really tough, she's a tough, gritty writer. And the book that I have in mind is called February. And the plot centers around the demise of the Exxon Valdez, which happened. A number of Newfoundlanders were killed in an offshore oil rig. Lisa is, her language is terrific. It has a kind of energy that I have rarely encountered anywhere, and certainly not in in Canada. It's almost like an American energy. I know that sounds stereotypical and kind of ridiculous in a way, but there's a driving force behind her language, and I think she's a wonderful writer. The other person who I've been reading recently is Edna O'Brien, I've been a fan of hers for years and years, and I have read, I would suspect, most of her books, and she has been very prolific. But the most recent one is called Saints and Sinners, and it's a collection of short stories. Fabulous, wonderful book. I'm not even fully sure whether it's available yet in the United States, because I think it came out relatively recently in the UK. But it may be, and it certainly will be in time if it isn't yet. And I think there's a story in there that I loved so much. I almost gave up writing. I thought I will never be able to do anything with this. It's called The Shovel Kings, and it concerns a group of a group of migrants, interestingly enough, but migrants from 1950s Ireland, early 50s, who went to rebuild London after the bombing that occurred during the Second World War. And they were in many ways very similar to the Chinese coolies who had been brought in to clean up after the First World War, and badly paid, badly housed, and there out of necessity rather than choice.
That's great. That's wonderful. We'll add them to the list of possibilities, and I'm going to look up Lisa Moore for sure. Jane Urquhart, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, and so nice to talk to people across the lake.
Yes, we feel the same way. We're looking forward to your next book, of course.
Well, thank you. I'm hoping another book is going to happen to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm optimistic. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Remember to join us, our new book club, at ncpr.org/bookclub. And for Readers and Writers, I'm Ellen Rocco.
I'm Betsy Capus.
Thanks so much. We'll be talking books with you again soon.